Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and we're talking about something that I know is right on the tip of everyone's tongue right now, the Farm Bill. Actually, I'm kidding. I know most of you aren't thinking one single thought about the Farm Bill, but actually, you really should be. And so to the end of elucidating what exactly is going on with the Farm Bill, which is kind of mired in a congressional cluster, you know what, we have the estimable, the admirable, and of course, one of my very favorite guests, Tom Philpott, has joined me today to discuss this. For those of you who are not so familiar with Tom, he joined the Center for a Livable Future in 2022 at Johns Hopkins University as a senior research associate after nearly 30 years in journalism and at least 12, if not 14, on this podcast. Most recently, he was the former food and agriculture correspondent for Mother Jones from 2011 to 2022. But that doesn't mean he doesn't still write for them, so keep looking for his byline. Back in 2006, the environmental magazine Grist became the first national publication to assign a regular staffer to the food politics beat when it hired Tom as a columnist. His 2020 book, I can't believe it was 4 years already, Perilous Bounty, was named an editor's pick by the New York Times Book Review and shortlisted for a New York Public Library Helen Bernstein Award for Excellence in Journalism. If you haven't read it, it's in paperback now as of 2022. Perilous Bounty has received in-depth reviews in the New York Times Book Review and the New York Review of Books, as well as, of course, many, many other places. And Tom's CV goes on and on, but we'd never get to the show if I kept on reading about how fabulous he is. And most of you know how fabulous he is. So, Tom, thanks so much for coming back on the show. It's been an unconscionably long time, which you can only excuse yourself by saying that you are a new parent.
That is true, and it is always a pleasure to be on.
You're so nice, Tom. I appreciate that. You know, Tom, this is my 15th year on this show.
Wow.
I mean, not this particular iteration, What Doesn't Kill You, but like doing the Heritage broadcasts. 15 years we started in 2010.
I remember the first time I was on your show and just
really
how different my life was, and I lived in a different place.
Yeah.
That was a long time ago.
A lifetime ago, really. I mean, 15 years, it's like incredible what happens in that space of time.
It was 2008, 2009, somewhere in there.
Something like that. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it must have been right after I started doing the podcast because, of course, Grist at that time was my Bible. I still read Grist, but not quite as assiduously as I did then. Anyway, let's go on to the Farm Bill because we have a lot of territory to cover here. So as many people may or perhaps may not know, the Farm Bill was supposed to pass. We get a Farm Bill every 5 years and we were supposed to get our new one in September of 2023. Tom, you'll correct me if I'm wrong.
That's right.
So we were supposed to get it in 2023, but because of the inability to function as a governing body, Congress, instead of passing a farm bill, they passed instead something that they called the Consolidated Appropriations Act, which has basically kept the money flowing to the relevant parties, primarily nutrition assistance in the form of food stamps, also known as SNAP, in the form of women and children, infants and children assistance. So those are the big food programs, and those are the biggest allocations to the Farm Bill. But then there's all the money that goes to farmers for things like conservation practices. So to just give us a sense of like what's in the Consolidated Appropriations Act that would normally, like how close is it to the real thing, to the Farm Bill?
It's pretty close, but it does make some cuts in some key programs. Most of them conservation programs. It kind of nickels and dimes a bunch of conservation programs that incentivize farmers to do things like prevent soil erosion or you know, make sure the water is clean that runs off of their farms. So there are some cuts to that. It doesn't mess with SNAP, which I think is really important. That's the food aid program. And it doesn't do much to, it basically keeps the sort of, you know, commodity subsidies, you know, the goodies that these sort of large commodity farmers get, subsidized crop insurance, payments for commodities, those continue. But conservation takes it on the chin a bit, which is pretty lame.
It's lame. And it's also, I mean, it is just unbelievably short-sighted, but we're going to talk about that in a minute. But just out of curiosity, what happens if they fail to pass the Farm Bill in September when this money runs out? Like, what happens then?
From what I understand, it's going to be a big mess. I was just reading a Congressional Research Service report on that. And a bunch of the big commodity programs, the sort of things that pay for, like I was talking about a second ago, that pay farmers to, you know, churn out all the corn and soybeans.
Right.
If they don't pass a farm bill, then the sort of New Deal era farm bill comes back into effect. Mm. And so you know, this bill from the 1940s.
terrifying.
Yeah. And so that really, so what happens is, so the first farm bill comes in the 1940s in response to the Great Depression. There was a massive meltdown of economic meltdown on farms. There's also the Dust Bowl.
Right.
And so the first farm bill comes in that context. And basically every year, every farm bill, Congress basically is part of farm bills. It says, well, that law is still in effect, but we're rescinding it for this next, you know, this next 5 years. And that's just built into every farm bill. And so without one, you've got this, you know, essential year extension, but without a new farm bill, that is going to kick in. And it's just a completely different context. It would be really complicated for Congress to enforce this, you know, 1940s era law.
Yeah.
And I think in the past, you know, we've had a few recent farm bill cycles. I think the 2012-2013 farm bill cycle was pretty rough, mm-hmm. where you get extensions and then you come up against this this sort of old provision, and usually it acts as a accelerant. Like Congress is facing this, you know, if we don't act, then we're going to, you know, basically it throws everything into chaos.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, maybe to avoid that chaos, that might force everyone to play nice and come up with a farm bill. But, you know, this, you know, we're in an election year. It's, you know, all election years now with, you know, Donald Trump running are extremely unusual, unprecedented.
Yeah.
We've got a Speaker of the House who's, you know, barely staying afloat, trying to appease his own MAGA base. He became Speaker from this sort of MAGA world. And MAGA really has it in for the farm bill. They really, mainly they are obsessed with cutting SNAP, mm-hmm. and don't want to be seen to be, you know, giving quote unquote handouts to poor people.
Right.
And so what's going to happen this time around? I won't predict, but I will say that in the past, This idea that things would be, just totally cut off, and, you know, the old, you know, the sort of modern farm policy would be cut off and we'd revert to this 1940s policy has incentivized Congress to get something together.
Well, I hope so. But I mean, the thing that immediately springs to my mind is that supplemental nutrition assistance programs, otherwise known as food stamps, did not exist in the original farm bill. And so, you know, they would have to pass an entirely separate piece of legislation to address those needs if they do not succeed in creating a viable farm bill that can pass both houses, both Senate and House of Representatives, right? I mean, that seems like kind of a major, like a major issue. But
yeah,
you know, let's talk a little bit about, there's a lot of money from the Inflation Recovery Act. Now, as I said in the next question I'm going to ask you, but I was in D.C. I'm on the board of something called the Conservation District, the Southern Rhode Island Conservation District. So this is an organization which has iterations in every single state. It was established by FDR in the wake of the Dust Bowl. It is a sort of it's a program that is run by the USDA, but is largely independent of the USDA. In other words, we don't have to do what they tell us, but they do give us money. And the rest of the money we raise through grants and stuff like that. So we went to Congress to lobby for three specific things about the conservation titles within the Farm Bill. And one of the things that we asked for was to maintain the level of funding from the Inflation Recovery Act that has been allocated to conservation practices in the last year and a half. And we're trying to make that allocation permanent. How does that, do you have a sense of sort of how that would work when it comes to addressing the quote unquote climate smart partnerships that you and I have talked about on this show probably 6 or 8 months ago when they first were announced, remember?
Yeah.
We had a long discussion about that. And so I'm just sort of curious, like, if they are able to keep the Inflation Recovery Act money within the Farm Bill, are those climate smart partnerships, which are made with primarily very large players like Dow DuPont or Corteva or Bayer, are those likely to survive into the Farm Bill with that funding, or will they also be dropped? Is that a possibility?
Yeah. You're saying so basically with this Inflation Reduction Act, Congress allocated, I'm just looking at the numbers now.
It's like a lot. It was like $38 billion. It was, or something. Well, it was something crazily big.
From it's 17 billion.
Okay.
And it's over 24. So, you know, theoretically it would be starting this year. I'm not really sure what's happening to that, and it's not the same every year. It's like supposed to be 700 million this year, mm-hmm. 1.3 billion next year, and it kind of stair steps up and peaks at 3 billion. This is extra conservation money from the Inflation Reduction Act,
right?
And one thing I can tell you is that one of the big sticking points and debate points about renewing the Farm Bill is that the Republic, you know, the sort of, not even the crazy kind of MAGA Republicans, but your sort of, you know, bog standard farm state Republicans who really want a farm bill, like,
yeah,
you know, people from places like Iowa and places like that, they want to take that money, this additional $17 billion, and arbitrarily turn it into commodity subsidies. They're saying that, you know, farm incomes are down, which they're not actually. They're actually up.
Right.
And so we should, we need to like sweeten the pot on these. And let's, you know, that $17 billion, let's take that, which is allocated in the IRA for climate smart agriculture, or for, you know, for climate friendly practices, and make it into, more subsidies. And the Democrats, to their credit, are holding the line on that. And, you know, that's one of the issues that never got resolved. And I don't see that as a red line for these farm state senators. I don't think that they're going to go to the mattresses for it.
Right.
I did an analysis of this right after the IRA came out a couple of years ago. And what's positive about this money is that in the statute, it says that this has to go to, it doesn't use the word climate smart. I don't think that's kind of specific to that, you know, public-private thing that the USDA is doing.
Right.
But it's got to go to climate-friendly practices. It's got to go to practices, according to the statute, that improve our performance vis-a-vis climate change by, you know, sequestering carbon, cutting emissions, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's actually great, because that doesn't exist for the conservation programs in general. There's no climate. That's not, just not part of the criteria. So there's this chunk of money that now has to be put to that use. So I think the battle is over that money is going to be, is it spent on things that are basically false climate solutions that prop up the status quo? And what I have in mind with that are methane digesters on these giant operations, giant hog and dairy operations.
Right.
So what happens is, you know, you get a giant hog operation and you concentrate all this manure and you spray it on a field. And because it's sitting, this manure is sitting concentrated in this lagoon, as they call it, it's generating methane. It generates methane in a way that, you know, pastured hogs out on a pasture don't do. They're, you know, going to, you know, they're, you know, generating manure into the field. But as it's not breaking down in this anaerobic way that creates methane, it's breaking down in a different way. And methane is not one of the byproducts of it. But when you concentrate it, you create this methane. And so instead of saying, let's not do that anymore because it's generating this, you know, really bad, you know, huge amount of methane that's a very potent greenhouse gas, what the industry is saying with the backing of Secretary Vilsack and the USDA is let's put a tarp over this lagoon and capture the methane. And methane is very similar. It's basically natural gas. It's the same thing. Burn that natural gas for energy and take it out of the environment and get something useful out of it. The thing about it is that the critique of that is that it's just adding one more income stream to this model that's very destructive. It's putting more burden on communities. It's not really cleaning up the manure. It's just taking one element out of it. And it's, you know, not really a climate solution because it's just putting more natural gas into the system, and we need to burn less natural gas. Anyone who studies climate change seriously and isn't sort of on the, you know, fossil fuel industry dime will tell you that we have to stop burning stuff like natural gas. We need to move away from combustion and towards stuff like wind and solar, and, you know, we can debate
geothermal,
about
whatever. Geothermal.
You know, renewable forms of energy. And so Biden and Vilsack are very enthusiastic about this methane digestion thing. And I think the biggest risk is that money go into, you know, solutions like biodigesters, which I think would be a shame. And, you know, one reason why it's a shame is that you're talking about, you know, this 5 or 6 year period where you get Inflation Reduction Act money going into conservation programs, you're talking about some years, a 50% increase in conservation funding. Like in 2027, the baseline for conservation funding is $6 billion, and the IRA adds $3 billion to that. And so, you know, it's a significant expansion, even if briefly, and it's going to be critical that it not go to these sort of greenwashing the status quo kind of programs. One that I really, you know, want to say, and there's a new report out from IATP, which is, what does it stand for?
International Association of Trade Policy, I think.
Yes. Or agriculture. They're based
International Agricultural and Trade Policy. Anyway,
yes, they're a think tank based in Minneapolis, and
yeah, they're terrific.
They have a paper that's just out this week that talks about how in these conservation programs, biodigesters are already kind of crowding out because they're really expensive. It's really expensive to put a biodigester on like a giant dairy operation or a giant hog operation. And there are just much cheaper and more robust practices. Like I've become a real advocate of agroforestry, and there's a thing called silvopasture, where you integrate trees into a pasture. You could do trees that produce stuff that cows like to eat or leaves that might be good fodder. And these are very, very robust programs that are, you know, literally adding lots and lots of carbon to the soil and, you know, providing a lot of co-benefits. And they're you know, available for funding in some of these various conservation programs, but they're just crowded out as this money gets taken up by these big biodigesters. So everyone should Google this paper by IATP that is about just that topic.
I will. You know, there are two things that come to my mind when you talk about this. One of them is that I personally do not see us ever getting away from the industrial animal agriculture complex. I don't think that we, in our lifetime, are going to see the disaggregation of animals. I don't see the industry being broken up to the extent, I don't see that we have the pasture for it. Like, where are we going to put them all? And I don't see people not eating meat. So that makes it a really difficult conundrum to decide what best to do about this, as you said, and correctly so, very destructive model that we have not only engaged in our own nation, but we have exported around the world. I don't really know what the answer is there. I mean, it seems to me like biodigesters on one level are better than nothing, which is what we have.
I think that is an important debate to have, but I really want to, I respect that position, but I really want, I want us to think about all of the other risk points in the current model
that may
make it a really bad idea. Like, we might be really screwing up by, you know, not reining it in. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I've written about that that puts, you know, real fear into me is the way that concentrated hog farming is a potential source of pathogenic and, you know, possibly pandemic causing influence.
Sure.
The way that hogs are mixing vessels for influenzas that circulate in birds that don't do a very good job of, you know, infecting humans or going from human to human, mm-hmm. but you get a bunch of hogs involved and you know, they remix these things, and, you know, humans and hogs swap a lot of viruses.
Yes.
And so that potential makes me really, really nervous. And we've, you know, already seen how poorly we did when we had a pandemic a few years ago.
Yeah, sure.
You know, just with coming up, you know, just so many, like, we forget about how difficult it was to get protective gear, to get masks and stuff. You had people in hospitals, you know, months into the pandemic scrambling for proper masks and, you know,
absolutely.
Swabs for testing. And I'm not convinced that the experience of COVID is going to make us do any better next time. And so that gives me a lot of fear. And, you know, we're already seeing a jump, avian flu jump into cows.
Yep.
And I did a piece for Mother Jones last year about just how ridiculous it is that, I mean, I was on the ground in North Carolina a couple times in, you know, in Eastern North Carolina hog country. And there's a moratorium on new hog CAFOs in North Carolina.
Yes.
There's a moratorium on putting in new manure pits, whatever you want to call them, lagoons. And so what's happening? The meat industry has not decided we're not going to expand there anymore. What they're doing is literally putting in poultry operations at a really rapid pace, really, really close to hog operations.
Oh, boy.
And you know, this is just a really bad idea. I mean, it is unbelievable. And I went to visit one community member, an African-American woman. It's a heavily African-American area who mm-hmm. lives. His family's been there forever. And, you know, 30 or 40, probably 20, 30 years ago, they got a couple of giant hog operations. And now there's a giant, you know, poultry operation operating very close to her. And we were walking down the street and in front of the hog operation, we got this really putrid stench of
course
hog manure. And then we walked not even a quarter mile up the street, and there was another putrid stench that was quite different. And the folks who were turning me around was like, oh yeah, that's the bird operation.
Jesus.
And so things are spewing, you know, they're, you know, they've got giant fans operating and they're just blowing right. stuff out of the facility into the surrounding area. This stuff is mixing. It is a really, really, really bad situation. And so that, and then, you know, the other thing, Katie, is that, like, as you know well, someone who follows the industry, in the past 10 years, we've had these pandemic pathogens that don't affect humans just eviscerate.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen avian flu be a real problem in Midwestern eggs. It's, you know, spread outside of the Midwestern egg operations. Mm-hmm. We've seen African swine virus, which hasn't made it to the United States yet, but decimate Chinese hog production. Mm-hmm. It got into Europe. So when you concentrate these animals together, in, you know, at such densities, you generate the potential for pathogens that could wipe out animal populations, and that could then also can jump to humans. And it's just a really, really fragile system.
I couldn't agree with you more. No, it's a desperate situation, because let's also remember, and then we have to take a short break, but let's also remember that concurrent with the raising of these enormous numbers of animals in a highly concentrated area is you're using an enormous amount of antibiotics to keep them alive.
Yeah.
And that's yet another, you develop these antibiotic resistant pathogens that cycle through these animals. And by the way, people, those are, when Tom was talking about the fans blowing exhaust out of these big barns, they're blowing that particulate matter out. And some of it, and I think, Tom, maybe you were something I read that you wrote years ago when I was writing my book about meat, but a plume of these antibiotic resistant bacteria will be blowing on the wind as far as, you know, Africa, like no exaggeration yeah. there. So you're spreading, you know, you're spreading these pathogens around the world on the jet stream, essentially. I mean, yeah. And people never talk about that, but we have to take a short break for a sponsor drop. We'll be right back with Tom Philpott. So please stay tuned. We've got a lot more to talk about.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
Okay, so let's go back to the farm bill. Even though I could talk about the meat industry with you all day long,
yes.
As you know, I can bore the bejesus out of anyone on this subject. But let's go back to the whole sort of subsidizing crop insurance. You know, they have included in the proposed farm bill language and in the CAA, they have included generous subsidies for corn and for soy. And then the additional money, this is something you wrote about, the additional money offered for enacting conservation practices to remediate that damage. They don't, in other words, the money that they get for growing fence row to fence row, as you point out, is, you know, X, and the money that they get for, you know, conservation practices is Y. Can you talk a little bit about the disparity between those and sort of what that has ended up costing us in terms of soil erosion, water quality, et cetera?
Yeah. I mean, so as you know, Katie, I've been covering this issue since something like 2005. And so I've been, you know, covering farm bills since then.
Yeah.
And there's been many farm bills, and I've covered, you know, many farm bill fights. And I just really, you know, here we are in 2024, starting 2023. I'm just sick of this debate about can we just get a few more conservation dollars? Can we put some caps on the subsidies?
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of this incremental nickel and diming. And here we are in 2023, 2024. And we've got this massive erosion crisis that I've been writing about. I have a piece in Democracy Journal that gets into this that just went up a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, right. I'll look for it.
Yeah, please Google it because it hasn't gotten enough attention.
Okay.
According to the author.
Well, maybe the author would like to come back and talk about that.
So we're in this massive erosion crisis.
Yeah.
I've been reading the work of these researchers from University of Massachusetts, led by a guy named Isaac Larson, where they're just showing rates of erosion in the Corn Belt that are minimum 30 to 40 times the rate of the natural rate of replacement of soil. They found that already a third of the Corn Belt has lost its you know, top layer of, you know, rich topsoil, and they're literally farming subsoil, and they do that by just pummeling it with fertilizers and stuff.
Yep.
That's the only way you can make it productive. And you know, here we are in another farm bill debate, and oh, can we get some more conservation funding, and oh, can we, you know, rein in the subsidies just a little bit. And I'm just sort of over it. And I've been talking to this professor, University of Iowa, who you may have had on the show, Sylvia Secchi.
I have. I love her. She's absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, she's great on a podcast.
Yes, very spirited.
Very spirited. And you know, so I calculated for this Mother Jones piece, it was kind of the first in a series of pieces I've done on this theme, that you know, if you go back, you know, to about 1995, and you look at the amount of money that we're paying every year to incentivize farmers to grow fence row to fence row versus the amount of money that we're paying them to incentivize, you know, to incentivize them to, you know, keep their water clean coming off their farms to, you know, this is conservation money to, you know, permit soil. So for every, you know, the way it works out is for every dollar the department, this is USDA, flashes in front of farmers to encourage them to grow to the max, it dangles just 13 cents to help them manage their land judiciously.
Mm-hmm.
And if you dig into that 13 cents, a lot of it is really just propping up the status quo with stuff like methane digesters, also stuff like you know, you can get conservation money to help you dig a lagoon.
Yeah.
So that even that dollar to 13 cents is really kind of generous. And so there's this tremendous imbalance. And so it's no surprise that we're losing topsoil at this, you know, really incredible rate. And, you know, we're going to climate change. We want to preserve our topsoil. It's just going to be, it makes us a lot more resilient. It makes our agriculture a lot more resilient to climate change. It's just a good idea to keep. I think we can all agree.
I think we can all agree. Yeah, absolutely.
And so what Sylvia says is this kind of revolutionary idea that instead of having these fights about increasing conservation and, you know, nickel and diming, you know, can we please put caps on commodity subsidies or whatever? Let's do 100% conservation compliance. And what that means is, and, you know, well, what that means is you go to the farm, you tell farmers, look, we have all these subsidies to give you. We'll subsidize your crop insurance. We'll, you know, give you payments, you know, if the price of corn and soybeans drops below a certain level. All that's still on the table. But in order to get that money, we're requiring you to show us your conservation plan, show us your plan to limit soil erosion, to limit water pollution coming off your farm. And the thing that I never really teased it out in an article, but the thing that I was kind of bouncing around to experts and everyone thought it was a good idea was show us your plan to keep at least two thirds of your land covered throughout the season. In other words, no more, I harvested my 5,000 acres of corn and soybeans in October and I'm leaving the ground bare until the next canopy comes up in May or June. And in between that time, it's going to be ravaged by rain and wind. And I'm going to see huge amounts of soil erosion. No, you can't do that anymore. Show us your plan to cover at least two thirds of your land in the off season. And this isn't, you know, command and control saying you must plant cover crops or whatever. What this is, I think it could actually generate lots of innovation.
Yeah.
And it could incentivize things like agroforestry. Like my plan is on a third of my land, I'm going to have various tree projects, agroforestry, alley cropping, silvopasture, things like that. On the other third, I'm going to definitely do cover crops, or I'm going to have winter rye. I'm going to plant winter rye on at least a third of my land. And you know, there's my two thirds, giving my subsidies. And I think it would just unleash a real just sort of innovation. It would just unleash a lot of innovation, and people would do it differently. But I think that they would be incentivized to do things differently. And the thing about it is, it's so powerful rhetorically. Is as we know, Katie, the Farm Bureau has successfully kind of created an ethos in the Corn Belt of you can't regulate me,
right.
Even think about regulating me, you are a jackbooted, Nazi, whatever.
Who hates farmers.
Communist who hates farmers.
Yeah.
Regulation is verboten. And, how I put it in the Democracy Journal piece was that, like, subsidies are birthright, but any kind of talk of regulation is jackbooted overreach by the government. So what's powerful about the Sylvia Secchi idea is that there's no regulations. You don't have to take the money. If you don't want to have a conservation plan that covers two thirds of your land or however we structure it, you don't have to. You can keep farming as you want, but you're not going to get these government subsidies. And so it makes it really hard retort. I think it would send the Farm Bureau into a conniption fit. Like, how do we defend against this? And as you know, there was conservation compliance in the 1985 Farm Bill, but it was limited, and it's kept on in Farm Bill since, but it's limited to what the USDA calls highly erodible land, which is a kind of a fraction of the land. Right. It's really hard to figure out how big of a fraction because the government literally does not keep data on it.
Jesus.
But it has basically failed. It hasn't been enforced. It has not slowed erosion in the Corn Belt. And, Sylvia will be the first to say that we have to allocate money for enforcement of this and probably take it out of the hands of the USDA because the USDA is so in tight with farmers. But, I just think it's an idea worth thinking about. And I think we have to start having conversations that take us away from this old strategy of, let's, change the Farm Bill at its margins, but just keep on doing the same thing.
Right.
Meanwhile, our soil is washing away.
Right, right. I mean, it's just, we haven't gotten anywhere near as far along in this conversation as I'd hope, but we'll just have to have another one. But I mean, it's just, to me, the idea that there is no enforcement for any of these practices. And I know that there is a big demand in farming in the Farm Belt, in the Corn Belt, as well as I know regionally in New England, there's a huge demand for conservation help.
Yeah.
I know that because I work closely with the Natural Resources Conservation Services, another part of USDA, which the conservation districts partner with. And so there is a tremendous demand for help with conservation practices. But there is, for example, in this new CAA, the sort of interim spending that they did, they cut the conservation technical assistance by something like $30 million, which means that even if you have all the money in the world for conservation practices, if people don't know how to use them, then they're not going to avail themselves of that funding.
Exactly.
So, you know, so it's like, I'm going to close with this one question, Tom, and that is partly rhetorical, but also partly genuinely curious. Who are these people? Like, why are the people making decisions about the farm bill so woefully underinformed about how agriculture actually works? Why is it that, you know, even the agriculture committee, which is in charge of doing most of the work on this, does not seem to really understand anything except for what works for the big guys? And there is, you know, there's no effort again to, you know, to go back to the pandemic to re-regionalize our food system by putting money into local processing, for instance, you know, stuff like that. Like,
yeah, I mean, there's a little bit of that, but it's not enough. But I mean, I think to answer your question, I think, you know, in the mid 20th century after the war, there was just this this sort of ideology that formed that, you know, we have solved the agricultural problem with hybrid seeds with that require lots of fertilizers.
Right.
That are going to have pest problems and so require a lot of pesticides. And this is how we do agriculture. And it makes it very easy. It makes it very productive. You know, there's no questioning the idea that there was this boom in productivity in the second half of the 20th century after these innovations really took hold. And that ideology is just burned into the mindsets of the farm state politicians. And, you know, one thing we should say is in that period, that sort of 1940-ish, you know, 1945 or so to, let's say, 2000 or 1990, when that ideology took hold, and that kind of agriculture really, you know, came to reign over the land, there was a massive, you know, basically push of you know, farm bankruptcies. There was, you know, not just in the 1980s farm crisis, but before the 1980s farm crisis, there, you know, if you look at the number of farms in the United States, and if you take a microcosm like Iowa, you get the same story. You mm-hmm. get this steady, the steady drop in the number of farms, and farms get bigger and bigger, and you know, basically the surviving farms, the ones that survived and sort of exist to this day that are now 5 or 10,000 acres, this ideology is burned into their brains. And it's burned into like your sort of, you know, mean average farm state senator or you know, representative. And meanwhile, we're seeing that this ideology, which did, you know, greatly increase productivity, no doubting it, is just destroying soil. It's fouling water, mm-hmm. And it's making us the opposite of ready for climate change. And I think that they just haven't been able to pull out of that paradigm.
I guess not. I guess, unfortunately, on that note, we have to say goodbye. But I will say this one last thing, which is that food security is national security. And so failing to pay attention to this is something that, you know, our children and grandchildren will be dealing with for decades to come. So anyway, we all have to get onto this same ship with this. But Tom, thank you so much for your time today. Please come back soon. We'll talk more about your article about soil erosion, which I'm very interested in. So I appreciate that. Thanks to our sponsors, as always, for supporting this radio station. And thanks to my listeners. See you next time. So long for now. What Doesn't Kill You? Food Industry Insights is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.